Hello, everybody. A look at the political campaign now from a slightly different perspective. With the economy the most important issue to Americans right now, a little debate about that, but there is relatively little discussion as a result of foreign policy in the campaign, except when candidates want to project themselves as presidential, as leaders with sound judgment who would carry the nation's mission forward on the world stage. The trouble is, a candidate simply can't compare to the gravitas of an actual sitting president. Even more important, projecting disagreement at home, second-guessing from the campaign trail, can complicate U.S. foreign policy sometimes.
This is not a game. There's nothing casual about it.
That's the president speaking there with some evident frustration earlier this week. With us now is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, contributor to WQXR's The Washington Report. Welcome to the program once again, David.
Good to be back with you.
So what is the complication here? Foreign policy often comes up in political campaigns. The president seemed to be expressing some particular frustration in his remarks, and I want to actually play a couple of candidate remarks from the last couple of weeks and get your view on whether they cross the line or not. What's your general view going into this, though?
Well, you know, there's this quaint, old, wonderful phrase about, you know, that political debate in the United States stops at the water's edge and all that. That's been out of date for so long, including, I should note, when President Obama ran for president and, of course, ran contending that Iraq was, in his words, a dumb war that he would get us out of. And you heard Republicans at that time complain that that was undermining a current war effort. We are past that moment. That said, the issue that has really burst upon this campaign, which is how to deal with Iran, is probably one of the toughest, most complex mixes of the military, the covert, and the psychological. And therefore, I think the frustration you heard from the president was you heard the simplistic lines that one can do on a campaign trail, and absolutely none of them particularly fit the current situation, especially because the prescriptions we've heard, especially from Mitt Romney so far, sound to me at least an awful lot like what the administration's been doing.
Interesting. We're talking with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. You know, and Iran has it all. In the next segment, we're going to talk about the extraordinary history of Iran and presidential campaigns. But focusing on this campaign right now, let's get another clip from the president speaking at his news conference that he conveniently called in the middle of the Super Tuesday voting earlier this week.
Coincidentally,
yeah, right. But here he's evoking this rule, which you say is completely obsolete. Listen.
What's said on the campaign trail, you know, those folks don't have a lot of responsibilities. They're not commander-in-chief. And when I see the casualness with which some of these folks talk about war, I'm reminded of the costs involved in war.
Now, he's talking about war there and being very presidential as the commander-in-chief. But when you read between the lines, you say what he's actually expressing frustration about is Iran, being second-guessed about Iran.
Well, he talked about war, but he was talking the casualness of war is that he was referring to were the suggestions that the United States should act militarily to end the Iranian nuclear program or should back Israel as it acts militarily. And the president was making the case that, and I think without going into the specific details, I think what he was saying was, we've been at war in the Middle East in the past 10 years. The American public seems to feel that we've run out of both money and patience for that. And that if his next line was that if the candidates really think we ought to go commit troops, they ought to both go explain their reasoning and the consequences of that. And I think the key element of that is the consequences, as we have discovered in the past 10 years. Going in is one thing, getting out is another.
This week's AIPAC conference, the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington, was a forum for the president. It was a forum for Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. And, of course, the discussions centered on Iran there, but it was also a place for the political candidates to go. And here's Mitt Romney speaking in front of it.
The current administration has distanced itself from Israel and visibly warmed to the Palestinian cause. It's emboldened the Palestinians. They're convinced that they can do better at the UN and better with America directly than they can at the bargaining table with Israel. As president, I'll treat our allies and friends like our friends and allies.
Mitt Romney, is that policy or pandering there?
Oh, probably a little bit of both. But what's interesting about that is that in President Obama, you had a candidate in 2008 who ran on the campaign line that we had alienated our allies and our friends by acting unilaterally.
Right.
What you're getting from Mitt Romney is that we've alienated a close ally by not agreeing with them on settlements, pace of negotiation, so forth. What I thought was remarkable about that line from Mr. Romney was that it was probably the only time in the AIPAC conference where I heard the word Palestinians even come up.
Interesting.
That, you know, if you go through Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech, if you go through President Obama's talk, there was not very much discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It was all Iran all the time.
Much more about Iran. Here's Rick Santorum at that AIPAC conference speaking about Iran.
We now have an announcement today that the administration has agreed to open talks with the Iranian government. That is in spite of UN resolutions that says they must stop the processing of their nuclear fuel in order to get those negotiations. Another appeasement, another delay, another opportunity for them to go forward while we talk.
An audible applause there for Rick Santorum. Appeasement, is that the right word there?
Well, Mr. Santorum had a factual problem here, which is that while the United Nations has called repeatedly for the Iranians to halt enrichment, that was not in the United Nations resolution a precondition for negotiations. In fact, it was an effort to drive them to the table for negotiations. So I think the president could accurately say that, yes, Iran is outside of the UN resolution right now, but that there is nothing in that resolution that would preclude him from talking to them. In fact, I think most members of the Security Council have argued that they should, and most members of the Security Council are in on those negotiations.
Indeed. And probably nothing to preclude the candidates from talking more about foreign policy as well. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, contributor to WQXR's The Washington Report. When we come back, we'll talk about Iran, presidential politics, and a certain incident back in 1981.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability,
and will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
Historical flashback there. That's Ronald Reagan, of course, being inaugurated on January 20th, 1981. The beginning of the story of his presidency and the entire Reagan era, but the end of another extraordinary story of U.S.-Iranian relations. That was the day the American hostages in Iran were released after 444 days of captivity. David Sanger now continuing with us, Chief Washington Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, and contributor to WQXR's The Washington Report. The ending of that hostage story on January 20th, 1981, was also the ending of an extraordinary chapter of foreign policy intruding into presidential elections. Can you recall some of the details for us?
Vaguely, given the time, and I was a junior in college at the time, so I was hardly covering the event. But
I was. Isn't that sad?
Isn't that?
I was. Yeah.
But the basic line was that there was a back channel between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians, and then the Reagan transition and the Iranians. And there are many who believe that clearly the Iranians held off on the release of the hostages until Reagan came in. And you'll remember this drama had played out for, 400 days of the Carter, the last year of Carter's time, and many believe it was responsible for his defeat.
Sure, there were many other issues there for Jimmy Carter, and indeed in the Iranian press all during that period of time, the loathing by Ayatollah Khomeini of Jimmy Carter and the at least in the press, suggestion that the Iranians wanted nothing better than to bring down an American president, even through the electoral wheels of American democracy, was something that Iranians spoke of, even if none of it's ever been confirmed. I guess it creates an issue that may be relevant for today in the sense that a political campaign, thinking back to the Iranian hostage situation and the sensitivity about Iran, a political campaign is an important moment, a kind of window of opportunity for various policy considerations which might never be considered outside of that political campaign. Does that affect the propensity that, for instance, Israel might attack Iran or the U.S. might actually endorse an attack on Iran over the nuclear issue?
John, I think it's entirely possible that the two other players in this who both have a vote, the Israelis and the Iranians, could look at the presidential campaign and see a calculation for themselves. For the Iranians, it's fairly obvious. What's the most sensitive economic issue right now other than unemployment for American voters? It's gas prices. And, you know, the running estimate is if you had a real crisis with the Iranians, I mean a shooting war kind of crisis out in the Persian Gulf, it could double the price of oil in 20 to 30 days. And so you could imagine what that could do to gasoline prices and how Americans might respond. On the other hand, if you're that's on the Iranian calculation. If you're the Israelis, you may calculate that if they do launch an attack between now and Election Day, that the president would be under much greater pressure to back them all in than he would be after Election Day, that he would have both Republican candidates and a lot of his constituency arguing that whether the Israeli act was wise or not wise, having started it, the U.S. should come in and help finish it. And that could change that calculation as well. So you could imagine this cutting in many different directions.
And I mean, during certain periods of time in American politics, the sort of pro-Israeli issue is largely a Jewish American vote. But in these particular instances, it also brings in not only Jewish Americans, but it brings in, you know, people who support Israel as a face against, you know, the Saudis and the old Cold War coalition that thought of Israel as our only ally in the Middle East. It's a pretty huge political coalition.
You want to make it even more complicated? Who is more upset about the Iranian nuclear program than the Israelis? Hard to count, right? But the answer may be the Saudis,
right?
Who, of course, consider a nuclear Iran to be a huge crisis for them. They have hardened their own oil facilities, but they believe that if, in fact, this does get nasty with the Iranians, among the first ones that would be attacked and whose facilities would be attacked would be the Saudis, who, of course, have promised to make up for any oil lost from Iranian production.
And there's even a final sort of Cold War echo here in the sense that the Russians, as of this week, have said no more sanctions on Iran. They have opposed the pressure that the international community is putting on Iran regarding nukes because they just oppose it on principle. They're also opposed to intervention in Syria. Someone like, for instance, John McCain would be very interested in confronting Russia on this issue and would be very inclined to support Israel even if there was an attack in Iran on the nuke issue.
That's right, but he wouldn't be alone. I mean, I think that you don't, for example, see much pressure on the president right now from below to, apart from Senator McCain, to get involved in Syria. But you are seeing a huge amount of pressure on Iran.
Indeed. And so do you think that going forward, this issue, barring, you know, even if there isn't a unilateral attack on the part of the Israelis, do you think this Iran issue has legs all the way to November?
I think it does, because I think it's only going to get more complicated, in part because many of the sanctions on Iran kick in full around July. And so the moment of where the Iranians are basically going to have to decide, do you try to negotiate your way out of this or do you react more violently, is probably going to come summer, early fall.
And the message there will be sent directly to gas stations in a neighborhood near you. And that will mean the commander-in-chief will have some explaining to do from his challenger, his Republican challenger in the election, correct?
That's absolutely right, although his Republican challenger couldn't simultaneously argue for being tough and lowering gas prices.
David Sanger laying out the contradictions and ironies in the U.S.-Iran relationship as it relates to the 2012 campaign. Chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, contributor to WQXR's The Washington Report. Thanks as always, David.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.